Hey everybody, it's Adam Chartoff, your host of FilmWax Radio. It is Friday, February 4th, 2022, and this is episode number 704 of the podcast. We have a terrific episode this week. We have two guests. We have one of the lead actors of a new international film, the official submission from Norway for Best Foreign Film at the Oscars. It's called The Worst Person in the World, and one of the cast members is named Anders Danielson Lee, and he'll be our first guest today. And then we're going to talk to the chief critic at IndieWire, Eric Cohen, back on the podcast. Director Joachim Trier returns with another modern twist on a classically constructed character portrait of contemporary life in Oslo, chronicling 4 years in the life of Julie. The Worst Person in the World examines one woman's quest for love and meaning in the modern world. Fluidly told in 12 chapters, the film features a breakout performance by Cannes Best Actress winner Renata Ransvi as she explores new professional avenues and embarks on a relationship with two very different men, Anders, who is one of them and who will be on this episode, as I mentioned, and Herbert Nordrum in her search for happiness and identity. The Worst Person in the World is coming out in New York and Los Angeles on February 4th, and then we'll enjoy a national rollout in other major cities beginning February 11th. I'm so pleased to introduce this first segment with Anders Danielson Lee, who I've been following in a bunch of his films, including a number of collaborations he's made with Joachim, and I recommend catching up with those films if you're not familiar with them, because this is one of the great filmmakers of our day. And also, Joachim was on an older episode of the podcast, which I will make available off the FilmWax Radio website today, in case you want to listen to that as well, with his earlier film, Louder Than Bombs. So right now, though, here is Anders on FilmWax Radio.
I said goodbye to me. I looked in the mirror, then I began to cry. All to see and hope that she will understand why. Ending the game is like changing the name of your favorite song.
Men da, hvis du glad i meg, hvis du elsker meg, så da fikser vi alt det andre.
Ja, jeg elsker deg. Men jeg elsker deg ikke.
Hi. That guitar I bought in New York, in my town in Queens, New York, in 1980. Ah. With my own money. I was in high school, I must have been in high school. And it's a Guild Blonde G37. And I've been playing all my life, but when, you know, like a lot of people, once we were locked down and during the pandemic, at the beginning, I started playing every day again, and it's revitalized a huge part of my identity, you know?
Yeah, me too. I actually bought a 12-string, a Guild from 76, I believe it was,
during
the pandemic.
Really?
So I've been playing a lot during the pandemic.
Me too. Well, let's just scrap our original plan, and we'll just jam together. That's, of course, right, Anders? Of course, that is one of the frustrations, is that, you know, if only people could play together, you know, not that it's nearly as satisfying, but it's hard to do that when you're obviously, you know. Anyway, where are you? Are you in New York or L.A. or?
New York.
New York. Okay. So I'm a little north of the city right now, but this is great. I've been following you since Reprise, or, you know, watching your film since Reprise. And I'm really enjoying your work. So I have, of course, one question is, are you currently neglecting any patients or?
You know, I've been trying to manage this cabal for many years. I'm kind of used to juggling between two careers.
Oh, yeah.
It's increasingly hard to do that. But it's also meaningful. And I think I experience that quite often, actually, as an actor, that my medical experience, my work as a doctor gives me another way of approaching this craft, and hopefully in a good way. Sometimes it's I have used it very specifically as a source of research for parts. Also in The Worst Person in the World, because I've met many patients in that situation. But it's,
and then maybe in Oslo.
In Oslo, August 31st as well, and when we made Reprise, I was working in the mental hospital for young adults with psychotic illnesses. Mm-hmm. So it's been meaningful.
Right.
Even though it's hard, I feel like I have learned something as a doctor from being an actor, because it's about communication and being able to communicate with other people that you often don't know very well. And I've learned something as an actor from my medical training, because I have another way of thinking. Mm.
Right. And now that you mention it, I mean, it might actually behoove anybody who's in the arts to have a scientific or not that maybe a lot of doctors go into. Well, I bet many people go into medicine out of the desire to help people. But it's like a selfless level to it. It's all about, helping people, the act of helping. And, you know, acting is on the other side of the spectrum. Not to say that you aren't helping people as an actor. You do. You can do a lot of good, but there is an internalizing and a process of going inward, you know. And I just sort of like that balance that I would imagine if most actors had kind of a feel like that, it might actually help them, because most actors aren't as in as lucky a position as you currently are, certainly, with your career, you know, their struggle for many, many, many years. And go nuts, because they don't have the balance.
There's something about the mechanisms and the algorithms of the entertainment industry that turns you into
monster.
Not exactly that. Well, it's you have to constantly work with your psyche in order not to become a narcissistic, self-absorbed person. I think that's useful to have some kind of, to have some good habits in that respect. But it's been more important for me to have a job that feels more like real life, that is in a literal sense in the real life. It's not a fictional universe. I mean, as an actor, you constantly step in and out of fictional bubbles, but the entertainment industry can also sometimes feel like a construction. Even though we need all that infrastructure, we need the red carpets, we need the glamour, it's a part of the traditions. But this film, The Worst Person in the World, is about basic human problems. It's about an ordinary person going through an identity crisis. And I like the idea of sometimes stepping into real life. I'm meeting a lot of people in tough situations, and they reveal secrets to me. They tell me stories from their lives that many other people won't hear. And it feels like a privilege. I feel that I have a database of stories from my work as a doctor that I often can use as an actor and in the work of creating a role, for example.
Those conversations, do they come from people that have just seen your work, or are you saying they come from when they come in for their COVID shot? Or I know you spend. I honestly didn't mean to dwell on this aspect. Of course, the press seems to be eating up this idea that you're both a doctor and an actor.
Yeah.
It's kind of being silly, but it does inform. It's fantastic to talk about it, but I wonder if
when it comes to COVID, I've been working that's more of a public health job. I've been supervising a vaccination center and working with the contact trace team.
Okay.
So in that job, I don't meet that many patients, but I also work as a GP.
Right.
So that's where I've been doing that for many years. So that's where I meet patients.
Let's just, because I failed to include this information from the beginning, I'll just mention it now. I'll insert that the worst person in the world, which is the film you just mentioned that you're in.
Oh, now you froze.
Oh, I froze?
Adam.
Oh, we froze. Let's see if we...
I don't know if it's...
Can you hear me, though?
Or yours? Denise, are you here?
There we go.
Oh, there you are.
Yeah.
Great.
It might be just a little bit of a wonky connection. Well, it's okay. As long as you can hear me.
I can hear you.
Okay. So if just let me know. Yeah. Mm. It's the name of the film is The Worst Person in the World, directed by Joachim Trier. Is that how you pronounce it in Norway?
Yeah, Joachim.
Okay, because he did this podcast once.
Oh, really?
Yeah, cool. With Louder Than Bombs, actually, and we had a great time. I was hoping that I hope to get him back on. And then it's going to open in theaters February 4th here in the States. And you play Axel, who is an illustrator, a storyteller, illustrator, right? A graphic novelist.
Mm.
And and you meet Julie, who is the sort of the relationship that sort of starts the story that you're, it's a really, and it's the Norway's obviously Oscar nomination or their submission, right?
Exactly. Mm.
And it's been this huge, I'm so glad to have seen it. It's such a, an unpredictable film, and the characters are also, yet the characters are also real in this movie.
Thank you.
That's a talent, you know? I mean, as coming from the whole group of you who put this movie together. I guess we have a few minutes left. Describe your relationship with the filmmaker and how that's evolved, maybe.
Yeah, that's a good question. I met Joachim during the casting of Reprise, his first film, and we immediately had a very nice connection. I think we're both interested in complexity in character and developing as much complexity as possible, because we both think that we are complex as humans. So we want to go as far as we can in that direction. And, I've grown up in his movies, so it feels like home to me. It's like a laboratory that I can return to and continue, reflecting on my own life and develop my craft as an actor, but also develop as a human being. And it's funny when you know someone as well as I know you, Joachim, it feels like our conversations in private sometimes is our most valuable source of research when we create characters mm-hmm. together. So it's quite effective because we communicate almost in a telepathic way on the set. We don't have to go through complicated psychological analyses of the characters. We have had those conversations before.
Right.
So
Right. I could see the through the body of work and the amount of sheer time talking, and that's invaluable. Yeah.
Yeah, and that takes my experience is that takes a lot of time, and it's also easier for me to take risks and to be courageous when I'm performing because I trust him.
And he trusts him.
I'm not afraid of making a fool of myself. I'd rather not want to be in my comfort zone with him. It's riskier to work like that. But hopefully we will get more unexpected magical moments in that way. I hope so.
Me too.
And it's much more fun to work that way.
Yeah, me too. You primarily worked with him the majority of your filmography, let's say, although you have had some other film experiences. And one is also, I guess it's coming out. Has Bergman Island come out? I should know this.
In the U.S., yes.
Okay, that's Mia Hansen-Lowe's last film. And exactly. Also, really, I know you have a role in there, and that's a must-see for any film lover, of course.
Thanks.
Just thought I'd insert that. But today we're going to talk. We've been talking about The Worst Person in the World, which is is it an ironic title? I don't know. You got to see the movie to figure that out.
My interpretation is that it is ironic in the sense that sometimes life puts you in tough situations where you have to make hard choices and you end up hurting other people
and yourself.
You hurt yourself and you feel like the worst person in the world, but it's not really your fault. It's just a part of the human experience in a way.
Well, I'm so excited and grateful to have this opportunity. I didn't get to half the stuff because we're limited on time. You're very popular, turns out, but I had some other points, but they can wait to a future opportunity maybe to sit together again. I would really enjoy that.
Me too. We should talk more about guitars also. Should have a separate podcast about guitars.
Absolutely, I'd love that. Just say the name of the film in Norwegian.
Verdens verste menneske.
What he said. Yeah. No, it's a great language. I know Finnish and a little Danish, but I have not been to Norway. I apologize. That's going to be, it's the last Scandinavian country other than Iceland, I guess, that I have to get to.
Yeah.
All righty. Take care. Nice to meet you, Anders.
Nice to meet you too.
Okay.
Take care.
Good luck.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you.
There's a song in my heart makes my love for you shine. Driving across the great divide, songs kept me up for the ride before I leave this world. Well, I hope you find a song that loves you for all time. And that song saves your life.
I've known Eric Cohen for many years, at least a good 10 years. And, you know, anybody who's in the film world knows The Hollywood Reporter and, you know, Variety. But also, I've seen over the last 10, 15 years that I've been following and covering the film scene here in New York and in general, the rise of IndieWire as a major trade publication. And their newsletter is read by anyone who has a stake in the film industry these days. So if you aren't familiar with IndieWire, become familiar with it. And Eric is probably, out of anyone, most responsible. And I know he would probably not enjoy me saying this, but he is certainly largely responsible for the growth of this exceptional publication. Their coverage is really astounding. I mean, not just film, but any end of popular entertainment media, I would say, is covered in IndieWire, with a special emphasis on festivals. So what we're going to talk about here are festivals and how they've coped in the last couple of years, and most especially Sundance, which he just attended. It was a virtual festival this year and something that was decided rather last minute. And Eric is also happens to be the brand new father of a baby girl. So I appreciate all the more that he made time to have this conversation. This is his fourth visit, and his third visit was a number of years back. We'll make those earlier episodes available on the FilmWax Radio website, filmwaxradio.com as well. Here now, though, in the meantime, is my conversation with the chief film critic of IndieWire, Eric Cohen, on FilmWax Radio.
Thank you for waiting. I appreciate it.
Well, baby stuff.
Yeah, well, I got a two and a half month old now, so you know it's
wow,
pretty unpredictable.
Yeah. You know, I'm not sure this has dawned on you yet, but your life's going to change a little, Eric.
That's what I hear. That's what I hear.
I hope it doesn't come as a shock.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I love going to Sundance, but it wasn't the worst thing in the world for me not to be there at this particular point in time for time management purposes and so forth. But
yeah. Or it's a girl.
It's a girl, yeah. Her name's nice. Eva.
Huh?
Her name's Eva with a V. And pretty. She's 3.5 months old. Yeah.
Congratulations. And where are your folks nearby?
They're in, well, they used to be in Seattle. They recently moved to Philadelphia. So,
oh, right now. Well, that's fantastic then, because they get to be around and, you know, they can kind of pitch in maybe sometimes.
Or yeah. That's the hope. We're building up to it. We'll see where we land.
Will they watch this, do you think?
You never know. I mean,
it's, I only say because I don't want to, wouldn't want to say anything that would, in any way,
create family discord. I think we're okay.
Or discord with me and what I'm doing here, like with them, because I just think, oh, you know, it's Philadelphia is like 2 hours, maybe even less, but it's like, it's just the right distance for them to come and it not be, they could do that in a day trip or, you know, but it's also not spontaneous, like drop off by, you know, distance either, like, or where you feel compelled to always visit and that kind of thing. So it kind of feels like a good distance to be.
From, yeah. You know. So far, so good. We'll see.
Yeah. And it's fine if she participates in the podcast, that's fine too.
Yeah. Sorry about that.
No, not at all. Don't worry about it. My little one is turning 18 in 3 months. So.
Oh, wow. Big difference.
Yeah. But it's just mind boggling. Because
mm-hmm.
the doesn't really is as cliche as it sounds, it's just went by in a flash.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm always telling people to be in the moment, you know, because it's like the time will take care of itself quick enough. Right. So it's like pretty awesome to be there for all those different moments. And and they still continue. I just took my son was up here visiting a couple weekends ago and you know, it took him out driving. He drove, like giving him lessons.
Mm-hmm.
So to see my kid drive.
The final generation of people learning to drive cars before self-driving Teslas take over society, I guess.
Yeah. That's a conversation. We'll cover that topic on another episode.
Yeah, no, I mean it's definitely a whole can of worms, I suppose.
Yeah, for sure. Automation and then also job, you know, the job sort of taking jobs, etc.
Yes, exactly.
So, yeah, for sure. So how's it been going otherwise in this? So you didn't get to go to in person to Sundance, obviously. So you did it from
Nobody did, right?
Right.
So, I mean, my first story back from parental leave was one about why Sundance was happening, because it hadn't canceled in the first workday of 2022. And by the end of the next day, it had canceled the physical edition. So I don't know if that story helped catalyze that. I know that it was pretty widely seen and circulated in the industry, but it was an interesting moment, obviously, because going to a physical festival like Sundance is just such a different category of experience. You know, like I've seen the contrast since COVID started, because I went to Cannes last year and Telluride. Obviously did stuff around New York Film Festival, and there's a kind of organic quality to being in those environments that has such a direct impact on the market, the way people talk about movies, how they're received in the room and stuff. So watching these movies at home is just it's just a different category of experience.
I didn't think of that, but yeah, makes
sense. But it's critical in terms of how it's changing the function of a festival, and I would be surprised if Sundance was not in person next year. I mean, knock on wood, there's no like ridiculous variant stuff going on then. But at the same time, I did find it easier to explore the lineup because it was just like right there in front of me. So,
yeah. So on a personal basis, there were advantages to it, but if you think about it on a broader sense, it's interesting because I feel like I just assume that what we're experiencing are temporary stop gaps with a festival like Sundance, where it's going to go back to something more familiar, you know, and then people will go back to it. I mean, there might be some obviously changes made if in in-person's festival again.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised. But it seems like what you're saying exactly about how a buzz is created organically is usually the result of not of like texting each other, but of actually talking and the excitement and the, you know, that comes out of the, and the Q&As and the articles written and in IndieWire and other trades. And, right. So
yeah,
the nature of how an article gets written could be you seeing the film and then, you know, having conversations afterwards or talking to the film team maybe, or I don't know.
I mean, it's sort of, I actually the last few years watched a lot of Sundance movies in advance of the festival anyway.
Oh, and
the
reason
I did that was primarily to be able to take advantage of the environment. And because running around seeing all these movies, if I can see them early, I trust my own instincts a lot of times in terms of being able to watch something and knowing, you know, is there something about it, quality or vision, or is it going to play big in the room? Is it going to be controversial? So, you know, maybe there are certain things that are valuable to be in the room for there, but ultimately for me, it's like, I just want to be in an environment where I can connect with the different kinds of stakeholders. So that goes from the filmmakers to the, you know, managers and the distributors and different programmers and random festival people who you're not quite sure what they're doing there, but they have a badge. And you just see this kind of, you experience that sort of like assemblage of people. I mean, it's like going to a conference or something in certain ways. And it gives you a sense of just where things are culturally and the state of the industry. So I try, I've like muscle memory from doing this now for 15 years. And so I try to like sort of, you know, recreate these things when they're not around me. So during Sundance, I would do like a condo party and just sort of send a Zoom link around and say, hey, come by the IndieWire condo tonight at 10 o'clock or whatever. And people would just pop into a Zoom. I use the little 3D film party thing that Sundance created where you make a little avatar and walk around. I'm really into that kind of stuff. So I had a nice time interfacing with people there. But you know, ultimately the most important thing is that the programming is strong. I did think this was still a strong year. There were some people I spoke to who said, you know, I don't remember the last year at Sundance where I saw so many movies that didn't, you know, become a big deal or sort of, you know, where there wasn't like one movie that really stood out as like the movie of the year or whatever. And ultimately I agree with that assertion, but not to the point where I think that that it was a miss. Because there were just so many different kinds of filmic experiences that I found memorable, whether it was these multi-part kind of investigations in the doc space with the Kanye West piece that's going to Netflix, Genius, which is amazing, or We Need to Talk About Cosby, which is a four-part Showtime doc about Bill Cosby's legacy. But then I was also seeing these other, you know, like weird kind of innovative, scrappy vision, something like Framing Agnes, which is like, looking at old, you know, 50s interviews with trans people about their lifestyle and kind of repurposing it from a 21st century context, or, you know, really wild midnight stuff, like Speak No Evil, which is this, it's like a funny game style sort of social satire. And the film that won, Nanny, it's the first feature of this filmmaker, Nikiatu Jusu. And she's hugely talented, I think. And I hope that movie finds a good home. A day after it won the prize, it was announced just yet. Actually, not. It was announced yesterday as we're recording. So a few days after it won the prize, that she's already got a new project set up with Universal, and Jordan Peele's company is involved and stuff. She's a really talented filmmaker. So just like ticking these things off at the top of my head, I'm thinking about like, it was a good year because I have all these things that I can talk about. From you know, every level of a kind of, you know, constructive cinematic experience and the kind of impact it has on the industry. You know, Apple bought a movie for $15 million, Cha Cha Real Smooth. I could tell you that was a good crowd pleaser. And Fire of Love, which Nat Geo bought, is like a really interesting look at a married couple of volcanologists in the 70s. And, you know, there's just so much stuff going on that proves that curating a lineup of new films at this level has real impact, that I'm like, I just was not convinced by this argument that it was a lesser year.
Or, to circle back to what we're saying, there might also be, because of the lack of that, these people that are experiencing that or you know, saying they're experiencing that might also be because there is a level of disconnected, or there's a lack of connectedness and opportunity to engage in the lobby talk and the parties and the, you know, and that there's an excitement when you walk into a theater with, you know, and you're sitting there and the lights go down and you're about to see this, you're the first set of eyes on this film, and then the people, you know, it's missing. And so that might be part of the reason why they're experiencing that.
Yeah,
it could be.
Yeah, I think it's part of it. And I also think that you know, there's a sliding scale that people have in terms of quality. And when the bar is set really high by something that stands out in, you know, as sort of a towering achievement, like last year where you had movies like Flea that we're still talking about a year later, you know, it's an Oscar contender and all that kind of stuff. It's hard to see anything without considering it in contrast to what came before. And I feel like that can be a sort of an inaccurate way of looking at stuff. So that's sort of where I landed with all this. Were you watching Sundance films?
I wasn't.
All right. Well, what can I?
Yeah, that's why I rely on you, because you're my avatar, as you. I started a new job just a few weeks ago, and I had to focus on nothing else really.
Gotcha. Yeah.
But I, in a way, it's great to hear you talking about it, because you know, a lot of these films will, of course, be at, you know, lots of festivals coming up in the going into the spring, so it'll be, you know, which, yeah, I enjoy seeing the, you know, supporting those festivals.
Yeah, I mean, it always starts off with a, you know, one selection that then trickles down to various kinds of regional festivals, and that's one thing I've been looking at, is how valuable they are in the kind of broader ecosystem for a wider array of movies. And I do think in a year with a lower profile, Sundance, with you know, where you don't have like the one film rules them all kind of outcome, there will be a lot of films that will probably benefit from continuing to play around even more than usual. A lot of times it's like the big movies get acquired and then the new owner might say, well, we're going to hold off on other festivals for a bit. And so then you get a lot of festivals that are sort of filling in the gaps with maybe smaller films that got rejected elsewhere and they need world premieres. But I feel like a lot of these movies stand a good chance at kind of making the rounds.
That's great. And you mentioned we need to talk about Bill Cosby, right? Or we need to talk about Cosby. And that is going to be on Showtime, right?
It's W. Kamau Bell's.
They produced it, right?
Yep. They produced it. So W. Kamau Bell, you know, he has this show on sure. CNN, and this is not so radically different from what he's doing there. It's just a different kind of subject and format than what he would tackle on his show, because it's sort of this first person look at the history of Cosby's legacy and specifically the kind of contradictions it creates within the Black community. So you hear from former people who worked on the Cosby Show, you hear from some of the victims, but also scholars and you know, yeah, pop culture enthusiasts and so forth. And it's a really well-produced deep dive. I mean, it goes through every era. You don't even get to the Cosby Show stuff until episode 3. So it's like you really spend a lot of time in the early days, the Playboy Club, trying to understand the kind of the origination of Spanish Fly as something that was part of this world and how it, you know, sort of became sort of threaded into an ecosystem of abuse that Cosby was, you know, at the center of. And then it helps sort of explain the pivot that a celebrity of that caliber would do to become more of a mainstream success story, and the kind of transformation into quote unquote America's dad is really well covered. So I was really impressed with that. And I also felt like, you know, I learned stuff, not only in terms of the history of Cosby's ascension, but in terms right. of how people are still grappling with their feelings with relationship to him. And that's, you know, there's so many people who have been, you know, revered public figures, then forced to confront behavior that's challenged their legacy. So I do feel like it speaks to that larger equation as well.
Well, now he didn't mean a lot to many African Americans, but he meant a lot to many comedians, you know, and I mean, he was like a hero to so many comedians. And so I was kind of wondering if there were any surprises in the, anything you didn't expect, but.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's hard to say what a surprise is when you spend so much time scrutinizing the lineup. I don't just look at the lineup and say, that looks good and that looks good and I'm excited for that.
Well, I meant even with the context, I'm sorry, of the Cosby.
In the Cosby thing. Yeah, no, but I was thinking about surprises at the festival. In the Cosby thing, I think the surprises are that there's still people who haven't come forward, and just the sheer level of control that this man attempted to exert on perceptions of him, even you know, in the run up to his court cases and stuff. And so, you know, it's kind of shocking, like, to see like a media outtake where someone tried to ask him about the blowback or the sort of backlash he was receiving after Hannibal Buress's famous bit where Hannibal Buress is like, just Google Bill Cosby. I'm not joking. The guy's a rapist. And he, you know, Cosby tried to get this news reporter to like basically cut out the question, and you see that.
Yeah, I remember.
You realize like, okay, so this is how this person contained their problems for so long, just through fear and intimidation. So to actually see that on camera, it's very different from just hearing somebody else kind of explain it, you know. Sure. But you know, there were surprises. There was a surprise addition to the documentary competition, which was Navalny, the Alexei Navalny documentary, which is really good, produced by CNN Films, looks at kind of recaps Alexei Navalny's experiences leading up to his incarceration, which is still ongoing in a prison labor camp. You know, this kind of democratic voice of resistance against Putin, who then became a global figure of dissent, is also very charismatic and good, you know, very good on camera. He's got like movie star good looks, and he had that whole crazy situation where he got poisoned and then recovered in Germany. And so the bulk of the interviews with him take place from Germany before he returned, as he's thinking about returning. Because obviously when he returned
voluntarily, right?
Didn't he return voluntarily and was arrested at the airport.
Right.
So the cameras do capture all of that, which is, you know, really intense stuff. But it also captured the kind of key sequence in the movie is footage of Navalny and his team figuring out the various co-conspirators who were involved in poisoning him, and then prank calling them on camera, pretending to be somebody else, and finally getting like a scientist who doesn't realize who he's talking to explain how they did all of this. And one thing you realize as the movie goes on is that when he did that, it was like CNN itself did a story about it. It was out, he posted it online, but I think most of us did not realize like that story did not fully translate. I remember when he was poisoned, you know, and then I think we had a lot of other stuff going on with our election and so forth.
Right.
But that moment where he's suddenly getting people on the phone and asking them about the way they tried to kill him and how it worked, it's so fascinating to see, because it's so rare that you get that close to something in real time, that it kind of like elevates the whole movie. So that was a really cool sort of unexpected addition. I don't know exactly what the life of that movie is going to be, but it feels like something that'll, like Citizen 4 with Snowden, will kind of stir up a lot of conversations and
sure
and be out there for a bit.
Can you get into any film?
What do you mean?
Like, well, when you're there in person, I'm sorry.
You mean you're just asking, it's like an access question?
Yeah, or just like, curious.
I mean, yeah, I have a pass. So that allows me to generate, in the past, they've been generous with the kind of access, but you know, I've never taken that for granted. I mean, it's like the ability to access these films is first and foremost an opportunity to do something with that access. So, you know, I'm sure there are people, different kinds of stakeholders at the festival, board members or whatever, who have passes, who just like go and watch right. films. But that's, you know, I'm there for work, so I have to work. So, you know, I'd like to think you know, there are a lot of people who might have that kind of access who don't use it appropriately. And I like to think that I use it in a responsible way.
I wasn't suggesting otherwise.
No, I know. I think it's worth, but it's like, I don't want to say, you know, yeah, you know, I get all the good VIP treatment. I mean, there's a reason why these kinds of accreditation opportunities are in place. And I try to work within that context. I do think there's been an issue in recent years where you have people who get accredited and they don't necessarily utilize it. One thing that I find really troubling with virtual festivals is people who get accredited and then just like tweet thread their reactions to movies, you know, like giving it to this other entity. Now, if you're a working journalist, I think it's just kind of dumb because you're giving away your ideas and your content. And, you know, like if I was an editor, I would say, don't do that. But beyond that, I also think it's just not constructive. I don't think that's a good way to process a festival experience in real time. So that has troubled me a bit.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating stuff. I'm just, well, you know, and I'm curious. I mean, I certainly appreciate what you're saying about you obviously have a very strong work ethic, and you know, I think that applies probably to the general tenor at IndieWire, my guess.
I would hope so. I mean, that, you know, I have a good relationship with my coworkers and I think they're pretty responsible people, but it is interesting. It's you know, IndieWire has been around for a long time and we started at Sundance. We're very deeply wedded to the need to do this festival right. So I can't fully relate to the experience of somebody who's not as invested and might just be sort of almost, you know, passive about getting some sort of access and how they, you know, treat it. That's not my world. I'm just too deeply entrenched in it. So I feel very like passionate about how I use that access.
And is it, you sort of felt that it's likely that you said before that you thought it was likely that Sundance would probably be virtual again next year?
I think that it will probably be hybrid. I don't want to say that with any knowledge of it. I just think that that's the norm. It's certainly what was the plan this year was to have a physical event in addition to a virtual component. And there's a good reason for it, which is that it brings in new audiences and it allows for the lineup to have a different kind of reach, and Park City is hard to go to and costs a lot of money and it's cost prohibitive. So I do think that there's value in that. So I assume it'll be a hybrid thing, but we'll see what that looks like.
Right. You know? I mean, for a lot of smaller festivals that don't have a, you know, that are very regional, let's say regional, not smaller. It's been a, you know, a lot of them have, you know, really figured out that they're doing two festivals now, you know, and are starting to understand, you know, they're beginning to get how to do it, what, you know, where it can help and where there's maybe, you know, waste or what have you, you know. So it's an interesting time. It's interesting to see what comes out of this time that we've gone through and how festivals will. It's fascinating to me anyway, as an observer.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's I wouldn't call it an exciting time, but I think it's a time of great change that to see that so many entities are being forced to evolve their approach, because it's all too easy to kind of rest on your laurels if you have you know, a sturdy audience that works. And the truth is that eventually, not to be, you know, ageist or something, but if your audience is getting older and you're not paying attention to the way that a younger audience is invested in what you're doing, then eventually, you know, the older audience is going to die off, and then you're not going to necessarily have a plan for that newer audience. So I think that what we're seeing is generationally, we're seeing an opportunity for festivals to evolve into some new paradigm that will work for an emerging adult audience invested in film culture. So that's been really good. And I'm worried about, you know, sustainability of festivals, but I also think that you know, there's a kind of scrappiness to a lot of these institutions that forces them to figure out how to survive anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm not going to make a Manola Dargis sign of statement about how there's too many festivals, because I really don't think there are. I think that the festival system, you know, sphere, biosphere, whatever you want to call it, has kind of created a form of distribution for lots of films, you know, and it's engaging a lot of the smaller ones can engage community in ways a lot of the larger ones can't, you know, or the market ones can't. So I'm all for lots of festivals, but, you know, they also have to figure out a way of serving the filmmakers and, you know,
right.
Through this time, you know, and maybe some of them can't, you know, it's not their priority. But you know, anyway, I know we both have kind of jobs to get back to. I have this gig. You've got another gig. Now you're juggling two gigs.
Yeah, the parenting does feel like a full-time job. But, you know, I teach at NYU, I teach in the fall. I went back to teaching like 2 weeks after my daughter was born, and it was fine. I mean, I'm like...
Was it?
Yeah, I'm finding that overall it's, you know... everything has its own place in the larger equation of how I break down my time. And I'm grateful to not have an office to go into in the sense that I don't mind being here. It's nice to talk to you. I mean, I hope that some of these recommendations people look up because I do think that there's going to be some really interesting films to track over the next year. And the Kanye West thing that's coming to Netflix in a couple of weeks, it's going to make a lot of noise. So I hope people look out for that. And then there's quite a few films that are still looking for distribution that hopefully will find their way out there before the end of the year. So well, lots to look forward to.
If we missed any that you know, you wanted to mention, you know, also you could just shoot me a text or something with them. I'll make sure the titles, you know, that I include them and I'll follow up on them, you know, because anything special that came to mind, but you know, I'm just glad for the opportunity that we could talk again. It's been a few years, and I don't want, you know, maybe we can try to make this at least an annual thing. If
not. Sure, yeah, you let me know whenever. You know, my schedule always is like unpredictable. Like there are times where people ask me to do something like this, and I'm like, sure, and then all of a sudden it's like I have like 50 things in a day unexpectedly, some of which are my own doing. But then there are other times where it's really quiet. So you know. I'm always happy to do it as long as it works with the schedule.
Yeah. So. And on my side, you know, I just have to go through the board and the senior executives and all that stuff, FilmWax Enterprises.
Yeah.
You know,
right. Your whole bureaucracy.
Yeah, exactly.
Everyone's got one. So,
all right. Well, it was lovely to see you. And
great to see you too. Let me know when this goes up and I'll make sure to share it.
I appreciate it. I will. All right.
Good to see you, Adam. Have a good one. Bye. Okay.
Give a kiss to your baby.
Will do. Bye.
Thanks everybody for tuning in. We're kind of getting back on track. Thanks for your patience the last month or two, where not only was I on hiatus, but I've been really streamlining the show. We'll be back, of course, in a week with a brand new episode. In the meantime, you can also visit youtube.com/filmwaxradio for additional FilmWax content. Please subscribe while you're there, and we'll see you in a week. Take care of yourselves and the ones you love.